Sundays are a strange day for me. Last few years I've been living alone, just over the top of that hill there. So 6-7 days of the week I hardly speak a word, and then on a Sunday I spend the whole day talking. So it's a different pace and tempo to the day today. So I'm going to just say a few words, general kind of talk and reflections on the Buddha's teaching, and after that open it up for questions and answers, because there may well be things you're interested in discussing that I don't refer to, or I may even talk about things that you're not so interested in listening to. Can everybody hear me okay? Yes, you can hear me? Yeah. Okay. One of the things that I think it's important to recognize is that when people think about and talk about their work or their academic speciality, they tend to use quite a high level of rational thought, hitpon. And then as soon as they start talking about religion, the level of discourse plummets, and most of what people, even quite educated people, say is a mixture of received wisdom, cliches, slogans, things that they've just been carrying around in their head for years without really looking at in any close and intelligent way. Now I find this the chasm, the vast difference in the way that people talk about things that they're interested in on a daily basis, and the way they talk about Buddhism is quite shocking. And you know, this is the why in Thailand, one of the reasons where we see so many strange things going on, you know, in the name of Buddhism, without people very often being aware of the contradictions. There's been a lot of talk recently, you know, about Buddhism being made the national religion in the constitution and so on, and yet there are so many very practical day-to-day matters which seem quite untouched by Buddhist insights, Buddhist teachings. One point I've made often is the absence of any concerted Buddhist lobby to abolish capital punishment in this country. It's to me quite strange that one of the very few countries in the world which still retains capital punishment is a Buddhist country. I would say the treatment of animals in this country, the factory farming, is totally shocking. It's shocking in any country, but in a Buddhist nation, one in which we believe in rebirth, and that beings can take rebirth as animals, and that animals have feelings and consciousness and deserve our respect, that the fact that there's not even a discussion of this, as far as I'm aware, in Buddhist circles, shows how little the principles of Buddhism, other than the very most superficial, really play a part in people's lives. So one of the slogans that you hear over and over again is that all religions are the same, they all teach the same thing, or they all teach people to be good, and you know, as if that's a meaningful statement. Whereas I would argue, if you think about it, it's almost completely meaningless statement unless you define your terms. So what do we mean by when we say good? When you say all religions teach people to be good, what does that mean? Yeah. And suddenly a phrase which seems most basic, simple kind of statement, suddenly seems a lot more profound. How do we decide what's good? And is the idea of what's good the same in all religions? A very obvious example in which it's not the same is the subject of evangelization. Now, in the monotheistic religions, it's considered good, virtuous, a duty to try to encourage people who believe and belong to other religions to change their religion and to enter your religion. Whereas in Buddhism, that's not considered to be a good thing at all, and it's not recommended. Even monks sometimes are called missionary monks, but a monk is not allowed to teach at all, even a word, unless he's been invited, first of all. So just now Seiya formally invited me to talk to you. So I can't just sort of knock on people's doors or you know, try to persuade people to listen to me. That's a very un-Buddhist behavior. So this is a very simple example in which all religions teach people to be good, but the idea of what's good is radically different. And there are many, many more examples of this. So in Buddhism, what do we mean when we say we teach people to be good? And why? What's good about being good anyway? We have to be willing to question everything, even the things that you take for granted. You have to be able to be willing to put those to the test. I personally, these days I've read so many Buddhist books that I really find myself enjoying books that attack Buddhism, or, you know, critical of Buddhism, because it really makes me think again and to see whether I'm taking anything for granted, and whether my ideas and convictions are firmly based or not. So the question of goodness, I think, only becomes meaningful when you have an idea of ultimate good, the highest. And so I would suggest that a definition of what's good is that which leads to or is conducive towards the realization of what is highest or the ultimate good. Now, in Buddhism, we take the ultimate good to be the complete cessation of suffering, which in turn is realized through the eradication of all greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, simultaneous with the complete eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, there arises purity, wisdom, and compassion. So here, straight away, we have a map, a guide for our life as Buddhists, whether we're monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. We're trying to lead our life in such a way that the amount of suffering that we create for ourselves or which we impose upon other people is gradually reduced, in which we are seeking to eradicate or to undermine and reduce as far as possible greed, hatred and delusion, and in which we're seeking as far as possible to purify our minds and to increase the power of wisdom and compassion. So this is, as I say, is a standard that can be applied however you're living your life as a Buddhist. And often Theravada Buddhism in particular is represented as being very individualistic kind of thing, everyone out, you know, everyone for themselves, you do your work and everybody everybody else does their work, and things will be sorted out by themselves. That's not really such an accurate representation of the Buddha's teachings, I think. One, because although there is great emphasis on being your own refuge and being self-reliant, and the fact that you have to do the work yourself, at the same time, your ability, your capacity to do this work is going to be conditioned by many things outside you. The society you live in, the values of that society, and the presence or the absence of good friends, wise people who can give you support on this path. So it's not purely an internal, personal kind of voyage, but it's one in which effort has to be made to, as far as possible, create the external conditions which will help you to be successful. So that starts off by seeking good friends, and friends who have the same kind of values and aspirations as you do, because you know that social acceptance is peer group pressure is extremely strong. And even if you have a lot of faith and a keen interest in developing yourself along the Buddhist path, if the people that you live with and the people that you spend time with don't share your values, you're going to find it very difficult. You have to be extremely strong-minded to make steady progress in that condition, in that case. So finding good friends and people who will support you in what you're doing is very important. The there's a program in America, I think, where they were teaching kids about teenage kids about dangers of peer pressure, particularly as relating to risky behavior, drug use, and so on. And what they do is they get these teenage kids that come in a group of four, and three of them would be actors, and one of them would be the sort of guinea pig, and they'd be shown a screen, and on one side of the screen there's a line, and then on the other side of the screen there are three other lines. One is shorter than the screen on the right, the line on the right. One's the same height, and one is higher. And so they're each asked to choose which one of these three lines was the same height as the one on the other side. Now the kid who's the guinea pig, he was the fourth. So the three actors all chose the one that was shorter than the real one, the right answer. So this boy was put in this difficult position. He was absolutely sure, there's no way. That's definitely shorter. And he really has to struggle with it, but three of them, they all say the same one. And then in most cases, they'll stick with their original choice and choose the correct one. And then the second time, a new set of lines is reproduced. They're asked the same question again. This time the three actors all choose a line which is longer than the real one. And this time, in almost every case, the guinea pig decides that, you know, his judgment of the length of lines is obviously completely skewed, because he's outvoted 3-1 again. So he just says, yes, it's that one, the same one as everyone else, because he feels embarrassed and he doesn't want to be made a fool of, and feels uncomfortable. So after this, the teacher points out to the child, look, even with something like this, something as obvious, as clear-cut as this, whether a line is shorter or longer than another line, just a couple of feet apart, you're willing to bow to peer pressure. So how much more so in the case of something like taking drugs? So this is an example of peer pressure and just how strong and pervasive it is and how important it is to have good friends and to also to cultivate within yourself the qualities of a good friend as one who's not encouraging the unwholesome tendencies in one's friends but supporting the wholesome tendencies. One's not making fun of or criticizing the faults of each other, but recognizing and encouraging the good qualities in each other. This is an art of friendship, someone who knows the right time and place and when it's necessary to give reflections and to say things which one finds difficult to say but which will definitely be helpful to one's friends. So not just taking this sort of social cohesion as a goal in itself. You see, in the West, often particularly in America, there's this idea, concept of honesty, which means you should say something. You shouldn't. It'd be hypocritical not to express your feelings about things. Sometimes that can lead to an over-confrontational kind of atmosphere and saying things which are in the heat of the moment, which cause pain for a long time afterwards. Whereas in Thailand it tends to be the opposite extreme and things that need to be said aren't said because people find it uncomfortable to confront others or to be confronted. And the idea of harmony is elevated to such high degree that it becomes a harmful concept. And it's instead of the harmony of the wise, in which one says, look, if I have do anything, say anything, you see, which is blameworthy, please tell me. I want to overcome these blind spots. And then the other person says, yes, well, similarly, if you see anything that I do or say, please tell me. So that's one kind of harmony. The other kind of harmony is, look, if you see anything that I do that's not really very proper, then you don't say anything, then I won't say anything if you do something wrong. So that's quite a peaceful way of living as well. You just turn a blind eye to what's going wrong and maintain a very superficial kind of social harmony. So neither of these two cases is the middle way in which the Buddha taught. It's sometimes, I think, assumed that Thai culture is a clear reflection of Buddhist values and ideas, but that's not the case in many occasions, and often it's a distorting mirror. To give you an example, in the monastic order, in the Sangha, we have the principle of hierarchy, of seniority, and it's quite strict. And it's I find it's a very peaceful way of living. But there, as a complement to the principle of hierarchy, in the original discipline laid down by the Buddha, is the second very important principle of mutual admonition. And it's stated very clearly that if a satyaviharik, that's to say the disciple of the upajaya or praupachara, sees his teacher breaking the vinaya, the monk's discipline, behaving badly, it's his duty as a disciple to admonish his teacher in a very polite and respectful way. Now, I've never seen that happen in Thailand. And so, in each Buddhist country, you see that certain parts of the tradition have been taken up and emphasized, and other parts have been de-emphasized. And in every country, whether it's Thailand or Sri Lanka or Burma, you tend to think that one's own particular version of things is the correct version, and the other countries they haven't really got it right. This is something to bear in mind, that this practice of eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, and one of gradual development of purity and freedom from defilements, and for growth in wisdom and compassion, is something that every person has to do for himself, but he needs other people and supportive conditions to be able to do it. So there's a paradox there, if you like. But the path of practice, as I say, is one where we have to be willing to and learning how to be with ourselves a lot more than we are generally accustomed to doing. We're very rarely present to what's going on in the present moment. In the 17th century, French writer Pascal said, all the problems of humanity arise from our inability to be alone with ourselves in a room. And this has become more and more true over the past few hundred years. And so our actions and speech and our values and thoughts and feelings tend to be full of contradictions and inconsistencies, and sometimes we can't see them at all, and other people see very clearly. And unless you stop and start to look very clearly at what is this? What's this all about? What am I doing? You know, what's my goal in life? Is how I am behaving right now, is what I've done today in harmony with the goals that I have for my life? This is very, very difficult, and it'd be a very painful question to ask, because quite often we can just comfort ourselves with some very noble ideals that we have without being willing to recognize that how we actually live our lives day by day, hour by hour, bears little relationship to those ideals. So the path of practice is one in which we need a great deal of courage and commitment and willingness to look at ourselves. Now, the Buddhism in the West is very popular these days, and it is very intellectually very respectable And a lot of people get interested in the study of Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist teachings as an intellectual exercise. Or they take up the practice of meditation in isolation as a kind of a panacea, as a kind of a magic bullet. If you just meditate every day, everything will be all right. But in the long run, most people find disappointment when they just take up some particular aspects of Buddhism and practice. You know, there's in America, we just talk about the spiritual supermarket, where you've got so many different teachings, whether it's Zen Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, all these different kinds of teachings, and then the Hindu and the yoga and all the mixtures of them. And so it's very easy to take a bit of that and a bit of this and mix them all together and sort of feel you're being very tolerant and liberal. But it's like trying to learn a number of different languages all at the same time. You get confused, and then you're not quite sure whether one thing means the same as another thing, or it's something else altogether. And how do you compare this, and how do you compare that, and do you need to compare them in the first place? So you get a lot of doubts coming up. So it is a matter of choosing one particular path and becoming proficient in it without saying I'm right and everybody else is wrong. This is the true teaching. But finding one particular path to follow and sticking with it is very important. And the Buddhist path is, to use a modern phrase, a holistic path, in which there's great emphasis laid on the importance of a simultaneous training and education of every part of your life. So in the external sphere, that means an education of how you relate to the physical world, and physical world starting off with your physical body, how you look after your body, and this refers to nutrition and exercise and so on. And then how you relate to the physical world most intimate to you, all those things that you call mine, your money, your wealth, your possessions, and so on. And then from there going outwards to the environment that you live in. So this is the external practice towards the physical environment, and then the social environment, your behavior towards the people around you, your family, your friends, your loved ones, the people you work with, the community you live in, the society you live in, and so on. Then inwardly, it's an emotional development, including the gradual eradication of negative emotions and cultivation of positive emotions. And then finally, the jewel of the Buddhist teaching is a development of wisdom and clear insight and understanding. So you can't just say, I'm going to meditate for 15 minutes, 20 minutes every day or something. It means taking on a whole new understanding of what your life's about and how you're going to, what needs to be developed in your life, both externally and internally. And there has to be a harmony between these. So, in the West, you know, in the monasteries in the West, I've been to many monasteries from early days, you go in the morning time and there'd be lots of Thai people and Asian people laughing and chatting and having a great time preparing food to offer to the monks. And then there'd be almost no Westerners there at all. And then in the evening you'd have like meditation session, and there'd be all the Westerners all sitting there and no Asian people. And this was the kind of the pattern for a long time. Whereas obviously the Asian people were missing out on the meditation, but at the same time the Westerners could sort of get rather superior and kind of arrogant and saying, you know, they're the ones who are really practicing Buddhism and that the Asian people are just attaching to the externals. But one had to say, when you looked at the results, the Asian people seemed a lot happier than the meditators. You know, the meditators seem so kind of grim and sort of, oh, it's so tough, you know, and and so serious about everything. This was a gradual realization of people that the offering and giving and sharing is something that opens up your heart and gives you a great deal of joy and provides the spiritual basis for these higher teachings to really take root within you. Without that, then Buddhism can be very dry and unfulfilling, and then after people sort of struggling away with meditating and think it's some kind of something you should do, it's good for you, like some kind of bitter medicine, and getting very competitive about it, or starting to feel that they're hopeless because they can't do it, and comparing, and so it becomes, can easily become a very worldly kind of activity, which is, one teacher's called spiritual materialism. So it's not just, you know a technique and you can sit very straight with your eyes closed, and you can do this every day and be very disciplined about it. That doesn't mean you're practicing Buddhism necessarily. There has to be the whole spectrum of practices that are opening up the heart, which are developing kindness and compassion, generosity. There also needs the practices which are developing that kind of integrity and straightforwardness and resilience in daily life, because without the precepts, then it's very easy to get lost and to starting to act and behave and speak in ways which are directly opposing and undermining the good qualities that you're trying to develop in the meditation. And after a while you find that you lose your self-esteem. And self-respect, self-esteem in Buddhist idiom is that which comes from generosity and from precepts. These are what give you that sense of self-respect, trust, and creates an atmosphere of trust and safety in which you're willing to look within and to do this work of abandoning the unwholesome and developing the wholesome. So it's a matter of being willing to look and to learn from experience. This isn't a dogmatic teaching. It's not one in which you have to believe in certain things and in which if you don't, then it's a real problem. The idea is that you're willing to use the Buddhist teachings as tools to train, to educate yourself, and in which you're constantly looking and checking and putting to the test every single teaching. So on one occasion when a Brahmin priest went to visit the Buddha was sitting with Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana, his two senior disciples, and the Buddha pointed to them. He says, this is Moggallana. They're completely faithless. They have no faith at all. And of course the Brahmin priest was really puzzled. How could the top disciples have no faith? And the Buddha explained that faith is necessary as long as you haven't realized the truth. And once you've realized, you don't have to believe it anymore. So this is a clear indication of the way that the role of faith in Buddhism and in the theistic religions differs. In Buddhism, it's a step on the path. It's a spiritual power or faculty. but one which has to be developed in harmony with other spiritual faculties, and one which has always to be governed by wisdom. And finally, one goes beyond faith, because faith is like the engine, is that which propels you towards the truth. But once you've realized the truth, you don't have to believe it in it anymore. So the kind of faith that we have as Buddhists is more like the confidence in a hypothesis. Like a scientist has a certain hypothesis, and he has to have a certain amount of faith in his hypothesis before he's willing to spend the time or the money or the research grant to put that hypothesis to the test. But once it's been proved, then he doesn't have to have that kind of faith or confidence in it anymore. So this idea with the Buddhist teachings, where you're putting them to the test, it's not a matter of, I'm a Buddhist, therefore I have to believe in this, this, and this. I have to believe in rebirth. I have to believe in this and that. It's not like that. But these teachings are tools which you can use to free yourself from suffering and from defilement, and start to understand what does peace mean? What's it like? What's the experience of peace? The Buddha says that peace is the highest happiness. Is it? How do you know? Are you willing to put the work into to put that to the test for yourself? Wisdom clearly sees the way things are, allows us to let go of attachments and to realize freedom. That's the hypothesis, but it's not just something that you say, well, I'm a Buddhist, I believe that. I'm a Buddhist, I'm going to try to see whether that's true, because that's what the Buddha recommended. He said, you bring me flowers and incense and all these kinds of offerings, and that's not really pleasing to the Buddha's mind. What's pleasing to Buddha's mind is when people take what I said away, reflect on it, and put it into practice. Okay, so these are a few thoughts and reflections that I'd like to offer you initially this afternoon. And now we can, if anybody would like to ask any questions, anything about anything I've said or anything else, any interest in discussing? Yeah.